Om, om. All right. Okay, nice. Okay, very good. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahavidyan Karava Vahai, Tejasvina Vadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahi. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi, Chaitanyam Sarvagam Sarvam Sarvagu Vashayam. Yat sarva vishayatitam tasmai sarva vide namaha. Very good. Welcome to you all for our weekly class on Shankara's Upadesha Sahasri. I'm forgetting which button I'm supposed to push here. Good. And welcome also to all of our students joining us online. Many regular students out there attending these classes. Nice to have you with us. We continue our study of this current chapter of Upadesha Sahasri. In our last class, you might remember we had a metaphor you might think is unusual, but it's not. It's a metaphor of experience of worldly objects being compared to a yajna. You know that yajna is the word for a Vedic ritual in which a sacrificial fire is created and offerings are made into that sacrificial fire. And that becomes a metaphor for experience. Just as you offer things into the fire, your eyes and ears and mind offer experiences to the so-called Atmagni. Shankara uses the term, the fire of Atma. Now, that may sound unfamiliar to you, but go back and study chapter 4 of the Bhagavad Gita, and it's a very dominant feature in chapter 4. Sri Krishna talks about it quite extensively. So even though I agree that it's an unusual metaphor, but it's, after all, if it's in the Bhagavad Gita, it can't be that strange. So we return to that. I think it was introduced in the last couple of verses, and we continue with that metaphor today. Let's continue. Huyante tu havim shiti, huyante tu havim shiti, rupadi grahane smaran, rupadi grahane smaran, aragadvesha atmagnao, aragadvesha atmagnao, jagrato sharna lipyate, jagrato sharna lipyate. And we have to jump around, the words are way out of order here. We'll start second line, rupadi grahane. When there is the grahana, grasping, experiencing, the experience of what? Rupa adi. Form, color, sight, anything you experience. And anything you experience would include not only objects outside you in the world, but mental objects as well. Vrittis, memories, emotions, etc., thoughts, whatever is in your mind. So, when all of these are experienced, rupadi grahane, then huyante, You can understand them as huyante, being offered. Being offered, this is a metaphor, just like sacrificial offerings would make be made into that fire. Here, these experiences, huyante, are being offered where? Third line, atmagna, into the agni, the fire, which is atma. Which is not, as I said, not a common metaphor to compare atma to that fire, but you'll see the significance of this metaphor. Shankara brings it out very, very well in this verse. And these offerings are like havimshi iti. Havis is the sacrificial offering made into that fire. Often ghee, but not always ghee. Could be many different substances are offered into that fire. So Shankara now makes the metaphor smaran, end of the second line. Remembering this, thinking about this, reflecting on this metaphor of the yajna, the sacrificial fire. Reflecting on this metaphor, you become, in the third line, raga-dvesha. You become free from raga-dvesha. And here we have, this is, Shankara is being really quite terse here, so we just fill in the gaps, so to speak. How does this edit, this metaphor, how does it help you break free from raga-dvesha? There are several aspects of the metaphor. We'll see two of them here, and then one more in the last line. So one aspect of this metaphor is anything you offer into that fire is consumed and destroyed. Gone. And remember in ancient times, ghee, most often offered into that fire, ghee in ancient times was costly. Yeah, today you go to your local store and you can buy a bottle of ghee for a couple of dollars, but in ancient times, it takes a lot of milk to create ghee, and even milk is valuable, and more valuable in ancient times. So you are offering something of value into that fire, and it's being utterly consumed, destroyed. The significance of that is to help us develop vairagya. Vairagya, dispassion. Raga dvesha is based on raga, as you know, the compulsion to get what you want. Dvesha, as you know, the compulsion to get away from what you don't want. All of these are based on placing a tremendous value on our experiences. Certain experiences are essential for our well-being. Avoiding certain experiences is essential for our well-being. That's another way of expressing this raga and dvesha. Suppose we devalue those experiences. They just come and go every day. So many, how many, what a funny question, how many experiences will you have today? I don't know how to count, but I imagine it would run into the hundreds and thousands, right? They just come and go. So then, why make such a big deal out of them? So if you can offer that valuable ghee into the fire, why make such a big deal out of all these experiences we have throughout the day? So it's a matter of... devalue is not the not an appropriate word, but to the right word is not coming, but the sense is to lower the stress level associated with those experiences. That sense of urgency about getting what you want, that sense of foreboding in when you're faced with something you don't want. Suppose we just lower that level of stress, that level of importance associated. So that is one purpose of this metaphor. And you can see why it's a little, it's not, it may not be obvious. Actually, go back and study that chapter 4 of the Bhagavad Gita. I think it'll become that much more obvious. There's a second aspect of this metaphor here, and that is offering ghee into that sacrificial fire is for what purpose? It's not for the purpose of burning ghee, right? The ghee gets burned and all that remains is ashes. You cannot say ashes is the purpose of that sacrificial fire. What is the purpose of that sacrificial fire? It's a ritual in praise of Ishvara. It's a form of prayer, to put it very simply. It's a form of prayer because these offerings are given to whom? And be careful here, not the fire. The fire is an instrument. The fire consumes your offerings and metaphorically transports those offerings to whatever form of God you are worshiping. So don't, many people have this very simplistic notion that we're doing fire. No, the very expression, fire worship, is the problem. Hindus don't worship fire. Hindus worship Ishvara. So that fire then is a means of offering. So a means of worship. So here, suppose we understand that Ishvara is Atma, present within you. Whatever you experience is like an offering unto Ishvara. Does that sound like karma yoga? Yeah, exactly so. So it's an attitude in which our minds are directed towards this beautiful vision that whatever we experienced is experienced. It's a different metaphor, but it is Ishvara looking through your eyes, Ishvara hearing what comes in through your ears, Ishvara consuming whatever goes into your mouth. This is one of many, many aspects of karma yoga. Karma yoga is to see Ishvara's presence in your moment-to-moment life. So this is a very beautiful metaphor. And that metaphor comes out really strongly in chapter 4. Brahmarpanam brahmahavihi. Many of you know that verse. It's often recited at mealtime. And it recognizes that everything you consume, it's mealtime, everything you eat is offered into Brahmagnau. Here we have Atmagnau. There the term comes Brahmagnau, into the fire of Brahman. So it's a very beautiful perspective to understand. There's a very poetic way of putting it. This is my version. Ishvara, present in your body, is experiencing the world. That's one way of putting it. And I'm trying to think there's a more colloquial, at least in the spiritual world, way of saying it. Let me see if I can get it. We are, it's not coming. Something like divine beings having a human experience. Ishvara experiences this world through us. This is the sense of that metaphor. And that's one of two senses of this beautiful metaphor. Again, go back. I think based on this verse, it's important. Sometime in the next week, please open your Bhagavad Gita. There's a series of about a dozen verses in chapter 4. I think it begins with Brahmarpanam and then continues after that point. So start with Brahmarpanam and read maybe the next 10 verses. You'll get that sense very nicely. So we got two aspects of this metaphor. One is vairagya. Whatever is offered into that fire is destroyed. Whatever you experience, gone. Comes, goes. And that's to develop vairagya. Second is this more devotional aspect of karma yoga. Ishvara present in you, experiencing the world through your eyes, so to speak. And now the third aspect of this, third, we'll call it purpose of this metaphor, third utility, use of this metaphor is given in the final line, jagrat doshaihi na lipyate. And again, we have to connect to smaran. Smaran, reflecting on this metaphor, na lipyate. You are not affected, jagrat doshaihi, by the afflictions of daily life, your waking experiences. Not affected. Now, none of this is obvious, at least to me. In fact, look at all my scribbling. If it were obvious, I wouldn't be scribbling all over this page. So when I prepare, I have to think, what does Shankara want us to understand? Often it's obvious. Not here. Anyway, you get my point. So third one also is not obvious. In what sense does this metaphor show that we're not affected? And here we have to work a little bit at it. Suppose you are conducting a ritual, yajna. Some of you have done that, some of you may not have. And suppose you've made many offerings already, and you know when you offer ghee, melted butter, into that fire, the fire grows larger and larger, and you keep putting wood in the fire also. Whatever you're using, some priests will use the dried cow dung patties. Nowadays priests seem to like to use parts of coconuts. Anyway, whatever it is, the fuel that makes that fire go. But imagine now the fire has grown quite tall, big fire, and you offer some ghee into that fire. What happens? If the fire has already grown very tall, you don't see any effect. If the fire is quite small and you put the ghee in, you see the fire react to the ghee. But here we're talking about not an ordinary fire, we're talking about Atma Agni. How big is that fire? Interesting, right? So that fire is limitless. So when you offer something into that limitless fire, how is that fire affected? It can't grow more because it's already infinite. Remember your math? Infinity plus any number equals? What? Remember that stuff? You probably don't want to. Anyway, you see my point, though, and that is this is a very profound Vedantic teaching. No wonderful experience can add to your innate fullness. And I want to repeat, there are two sides here, I want to repeat them both. Number one, no experience can add to your innate fullness. No catastrophe can decrease your innate fullness. The metaphor given in many scriptures, like the ocean, all the waters of, also in Bhagavad Gita this metaphor comes, all the rivers of the world run into the ocean, the level doesn't go up. Of course, don't tell me you're saying, but Swamiji, what about we're melting all the glaciers? Come on. I don't think that fits into our discussion right here, so we can set that aside. So anyway, the metaphor that comes back, yeah, certainly back in the time of Bhagavad Gita, Mahabharata, global warming wasn't on the radar, so to speak. Okay, so here, let's finish this up. So the metaphor that comes in Gita and elsewhere is all the rivers run into the ocean, the level doesn't go up, and conversely, and it doesn't say this in the Gita, but it's also true, that every day an unthinkably large volume of water is evaporated from the oceans, and the levels don't go down. So, this is a metaphor. Atmagni, the fire of Atma, is an infinite fire, a boundaryless, limitless fire. Therefore, when you and we'll mix the metaphor intentionally here, when you consume a pleasant experience, Atma doesn't get happy. And when you consume a painful experience, an undesirable experience, Atma doesn't shrink. You get the point. Okay, so here we see the metaphor applied to the, he says, jagrat, waking state. So all of this applies in the waking state. In the next two verses, we're going to see an application of the same metaphor to the dream state and the deep sleep state. Why? This happens to be one of Shankara's favorite topics. Avastha Traya. These three avasthas, three states of experience, waking, dream, and sleep. And please note, there are three states of experience. They are not three states of consciousness, as many, many people wrongly say. Consciousness has no states. There's no high. People love this language nowadays, higher consciousness. Oh, you're stuck in a very low level of consciousness raising. We have all this kind of language. Consciousness understood as it is in Advaita Vedanta is unchanging. Therefore, no levels, no states. There are not three states of consciousness. We're talking about three states of experience. Waking, dream, and sleep. So we finished waking. Let's see. Dream. Manase tu grahe vyaktaha. Manase tu grahe vyaktaha. So vidya karma vasanam. So vidya karma vasanam. Pashyan sthai chasahat muktaha. Pashyan sthai chasahat muktaha. Swayam jyoti prakashita. Swayam jyoti prakashita. The Visarga at the end is incorrect. Prakashita, a typo. There should be no Visarga at the end. Okay. So now dream state. And he uses, Shankara's language is wonderful here. Manase grihe. When you dream, you create a dream world where manasa griha, in the room of your mind. Nice. So in the room of your mind arises a dream world, vyaktaha. That dream world arises in your mind, and saha, that dream world comes how? He says, due to avidya karma vasanam. Due to these vasanas, impressions in your mind, impressions. Your mind is conditioned, that's a better language. Your mind is conditioned by avidya, ignorance, and karma, action. What does that mean? In dream, remember we're talking about dream state now. In a dream, your mind is conditioned by ignorance. You don't know you're dreaming. You think it's real. So that is the presence of ignorance. Your mind is, here vasana, you can I think, better to understand it as a mind that's conditioned. So your mind is conditioned by avidya, ignorance, and a dream. Also, your mind is conditioned by karma. All karma, action, all the actions you have done in the waking state. Actually, here vasana works quite nicely. Both vasana works in both senses. So the actions you do in the waking state all leave impressions, vasanas. Everything you experience leaves a trace. Memory is a simple example of that. So the memories, you know, that everything that occurs in your dream comes from memory and imagination. Okay. Where do those memories come from? Waking state experiences represented by the word karma here. So all of that is vyaktaha, manifest. All of those dream things are manifest, manase grahe, in your mind. And he says pashyan in the third line, seeing them. And seeing them, let me just check, yeah. So seeing them, pashyan, is meant, this is Shankara's, I guess he just assumes that you can follow this stuff quite well. Not obvious. This word pashyan, I believe, reaches back to smaran in the prior verse. Pashyan, seeing. They're both present participles. But it's in rhetoric, they call this parallel structure. Sometimes if you're reading some kind of sophisticated essay, you have to pay attention to structural details in that essay, otherwise you won't get the sense of it. This is an example of a structural detail, and that is the parallelism between smaran and pashyan. Sorry to bore you with this detail, but that's important to get the right meaning. So pashyan, seeing this in light of the metaphor that's been under discussion for a while. Notice Shankara in this verse doesn't mention the metaphor at all. But he refers to it with the word pashyan. Seeing the activities in your dream in the light of this metaphor. In the waking state, whatever is offered into the fire of Atma is offered by your sense organs and your mind. The difference is in the dream state, whatever you're offering into the fire of Atma is no longer offered by your external senses, offered by your mind alone, but still being offered. So all your dream experiences are similarly offered into that fire of Atma, and we saw before the significances of that metaphor. We need not go over that, we just discussed it. So with all of that in mind, we can understand then that whatever you experience in a waking state is experienced by Ishvara, experienced by, yeah, let it be like that. Experienced by Ishvara's presence within you in the waking state. Everything that occurs in a dream, experienced by Ishvara's presence within you. And again, Ishvara's presence is that Atma, Agni, that fire of consciousness. And here, Shankara now makes a reference. He says, Atma, okay. Uktaha, the end of the third line, Atma is Uktaha, is called Taijasaha. In this context, Atma is called Taijasa. And here Shankara presumes that you've already studied the Mandukya Upanishad, where this very important term comes. The Mandukya Upanishad is famous for its deconstruction of Om into A-Uma and its analysis of these three states of experience, waking, dream, deep sleep. And the Upanishad makes it very clear that Atma takes a different role in each of the three states. A different role, different relationship with body and mind. In the waking state, Atma is in relationship, and that relationship we'll put in quotation marks and skip a very complicated discussion there. Anyway, we'll say Atma, I'll correct my language so we can skip all of that. Atma is in the presence of the body and mind during the waking state. For that reason, in the waking state, Atma is called Vaishwanara. This is a technical term used in Mandukya. Vaishwanara means the person who is complete everywhere. So everywhere meaning complete, related to the world outside, related to the world inside. So in Mandukya Upanishad, Vaishwanara is a technical term to refer to Atma in the waking state. Here, Shankara refers to the name given for Atma in a dream state. Taijasa literally means the shining one. Atma is present in a dream state, but whereas in a waking state, Atma is in the presence of body, mind, and external world, in a dream state, Atma is in the presence not of your body. Your body is not recognized, physical body, not in the presence of the external world either. Only your mind is present to Atma in the dream state. Atma is called Taijasa, the shining one, which is, and it is described as Swayam Jyotihi, self-shining, and Prakashita, the illuminator. Prakashita. And good to introduce the word here, Sakshi, the awareful witness, the observer. Just as in the waking state, all your experiences are observed by consciousness, revealed by consciousness, the same is true in the dream state as well. And the significance here, go back to that fire metaphor, is just like this infinite fire of Atma in the waking state can't grow larger or smaller. It's already infinite in the same way in a dream state. Whatever dream you have doesn't add or detract from Atma. Sometimes you have a bad dream and you wake up and you have the emotions associated with that bad dream. Atma is unaffected. In fact, Atma reveals the fact that the bad dream left some emotional baggage. Baggage is not the right word here. Some emotional remnants of that. The dream is over, but the emotions aren't over. Isn't that true? When you wake up, and just a side observation, when you wake up, your experience of the dream instantly comes to an end. The emotions carry on. Isn't that interesting? Dream experience comes to an end, why don't the emotions end? That's the nature of emotions. They change very slowly. So even though the experience comes to an end, the emotions carry on. Okay, so this is Atma in the dream state called Taijasa, and that Atma is unchanging. That's the important point here, the take-home point, so to speak, is Atma is unaffected by whatever happens in a waking state. Atma is equally unaffected by whatever happens in the dream state. Now, what about what happens in deep sleep? Vishaya vasana vapi, Vishaya vasana vapi, Chodyante naiva karma bihi, Chodyante naiva karma bihi, Yada buddhau tada gneyaha, Yada buddhau tada gneyaha, Prajñātmā hyananyadrika, Prajñātmā hyananyadrika. looking to see if there's an easier way to explain this. So in the waking state, you experience vishayaha, objects of your senses. You're experiencing the image of me right now. Also, in dream, vishayaha, objects, refers to waking state experiences. Vasanaha, impressions, refers to the experience in dream. So vishayaha, waking experiences. Vasanaha, dream experiences, vapi. Both of these, chodyante, na chodyante, are not produced karmabihi, by the activities of your mind, by any action. They are not produced, and we have to add here, and I've added in parentheses, in deep sleep. In the condition of deep sleep, you have no vishaya, objects born of your sense organs, and in dream you have experiences of objects born of impressions. Both of these are absent in deep sleep, is this point. Nachodyante. And yada buddhau, when your mind is in such a condition where it has no objects born of your senses and no objects born of your mind, what's left? The source of object of mental objects. Mental objects can arise from your five senses. In deep sleep, your five senses are turned off. In dream, vrittis can arise from vasana, from impressions. But in the state of deep sleep, your mind is resolved. Those vasanas remain present, but they're incapable of creating vrittis in deep sleep. So, yada buddhau, when your mind is in such a state, and such a state means no vrittis born of external objects, no vrittis born of internal objects, what's left? And you would say, kuch nahi, nothing remains. So, in that condition, when the mind is perfectly silent, tada, then, in that case, atma, your true self, consciousness, jnayaha, is understood as prajnaha. This is the third word drawn from the Mandukya Upanishad, the third name for atma in a particular state. Atma in the waking state is called Vaishwanara, by the way. There's no need to remember these terms or technical terms, mostly associated with that particular Upanishad. They're not that important. Anyway, atma in the waking state, Vaishwanara. Atma in a dream state, Taijasa. Atma in dream sleep is called Prajna. How many atmas are we talking about? Okay, just to make sure that we're not getting off on a wrong thing here. These are three situations in which atma is found. They're not three atmas. For example, I came up with a metaphor. I've never used this in a class. Let me use it now, see if it works for you. Right now I'm sitting. If I stand up, am I a different person? So a standing Swami is like waking state, a sitting Swami is like dream state, and a horizontal Swami is like deep sleep state. How many Swamis? That's the point. Okay, so these atma in three conditions, not even, do you see the problem with that expression? Atma, there are three conditions. But the conditions are not of atma. They're three conditions of the mind. Okay, you understand that well. Okay. So Shankara concludes here that atma, present in the complete absence of any mental activities whatsoever in deep sleep, it's called prajnaha. That's just a technical term. It means the one who remains fully conscious, is what it is. We've discussed how many times that your consciousness remains absolutely the same in deep sleep. You are fully conscious in deep sleep. We won't return to that argument. We've discussed it too many times. So he, indeed, that Atma is Ananya Drik, the one who is Drik, seer, but Ananya, a seer which is Ananya, which becomes nothing else. A seer which becomes nothing else looks like a reference to something we discussed in our last class. A seer that doesn't blink, an unblinking seer, an unwavering seer. Alupta Drik, I think we used the term in a prior class. And remember in a prior class I made mention of this Vijnanavada, this Buddhist theory that Atma consciousness flickers, momentary consciousness. We talked about how that's refuted. And I think there's a connection here because this Vijnanavada, first of all, you won't find it discussed in most texts. One text where you do find it, however, is in Gaudapada's Karika on Mandukya Upanishad. So in the Gaudapada Karika on the same Mandukya Upanishad we're referring to, Gaudapada discusses this Vijnanavada and Shankara comments on that quite extensively. And I think this is on Shankara's mind right now. I find that it's like... for me it's kind of fun to imagine what was Shankara teaching at the time when he composed these verses. You kind of imagine what his mind had been engrossed with at the time of composing these verses. Maybe he was teaching his commentary on Mandukya Karika. I have no idea. Anyway, there's several references here to the Mandukya Upanishad. Okay, we have now seen this metaphor of the sacrificial fire representing experience. Everything offered into that sacrificial fire is consumed, given to Ishvara. All of your experiences are consumed metaphorically by the so-called fire of consciousness, Atma Agni, and in that way experienced by Ishvara through you. Very nice poetic way of seeing it. And we've seen this now in waking dream and deep sleep. And now Shankaracharya wants to conclude that topic. Again, looking at this three states of experience. And when I say it's one of his favorite topics, I'm not kidding. This is every author has certain favorite things they like to write about or talk about, and this appears to be one of Shankara's favorite topics. So with that in mind, we'll see this verse and it'll conclude our discussion today. Mano buddhindriyanam ya, mano buddhindriyanam ya, avastha karma chodita, avastha karma chodita, chaitanye naiva bhasyante, chaitanye naiva bhasyante, ravineva ghatadayaha, ravineva ghatadayaha. In the second line, avastaha, plural. These three conditions, three states. And again, not conditions of consciousness, not states of consciousness, three conditions or states of your mind. And we can best call them states of experience. Your mind is the organ for experience, right? So states of mind, states of experience, they mean the same thing. So, so these three states, avastaha, and in the, these are states of what? States of, in the first line, states of your manas, mind, buddhi, intellect, and here he differentiates between the two. The states of manas, mind, buddhi, intellect, and indriya, senses. So these are the three factors involved. In the waking state, all three of those factors are involved. In the dream state, two of the three factors are involved, manas and buddhi. And in deep sleep, zero of the three factors are involved. All of that is so therefore, these avastaha, these three conditions of the mind, are karma choditaha. They are determined by karma. There's several ways of interpreting that. It's not his real main point. You know, why do you... This is just an interesting observation. Why do you wake up? Why don't you just... I mean, after all, sleeping is so nice. Why wake up? Of course, medical science has a very thorough explanation. Some reticular cortex, I forget what it is. Anyway, your brain actually has a circuit that makes you wake up. So anyway, in ancient times, they didn't understand anything about that. So they thought you woke up. Look at, this is an ancient way of understanding why you wake up. And the reason is, when you are dreaming, those dreams exhaust certain karmas. If you have good dreams, you're exhausting good karmas. If you have bad dreams, you're exhausting... Remember, karmas are exhausted through experience. Does that mean only waking experience? Who said? Any experience exhausts karma. You exhaust karma in dreams. People don't think about it, but according to the doctrine of karma, you exhaust good and bad karmas during your dreams, depending if they're good or bad dreams. And when you went to sleep, you had certain karmas that were going to be exhausted in that dream. When they're exhausted, you wake up. This is an ancient worldview. You don't have to accept it today, but it's how they understood things in ancient times. Your dream karma is exhausted and you wake up. So waking, dream, and sleep then can be considered in this ancient worldview to be regulated by karma. That's what Shankara says here, karma chodita. So these three states regulated by karma, these three states bhasyante, third line. These three states, whatever occurs in these three states, bhasyante, is revealed chaitanyena eva, by consciousness alone. I don't need to explain that. This is a central topic that Shankara has been discussing here again and again. But the key point, and I want to bring this up again and again, is that conventional thought has it that consciousness is affected by everything you experience, right? When sadness is present in your mind, does that sadness belong to your mind, or does that sadness belong to you, the conscious being? Seems to belong to the conscious being, but that's incorrect. Properly understood, sadness is a property of the mind. Consciousness that reveals that property of the mind is unchanging consciousness. And to explain that, Shankara gives a metaphor, Ravina Eva Gatadayaha. Nirgata. So he says, Gatadayaha just like pots, etc., are illumined, ravina, by the sun. And the point, of course, is, how is the sun affected if it shines on this pot? And suppose it is a pot full of ghee. Does the sun become happy? Suppose it's a pot full of, I won't say, you can, whatever you want to use, some undesirable substance. Suppose the pot is full of that. How does the sun get affected? Pot represents your mind. The pot is full of milk or ghee, valuable stuff. Your mind is full of valuable stuff. How is consciousness affected? This pot is full of the other kind of stuff. Your mind is full of undesirable stuff, like sadness I just referred to. How is consciousness affected? That's the real point. That consciousness is unchanging. In that ritual fire, and maybe that's the, remember, every, we'll just return to this important point, every metaphor has limitations. So if you want to argue, but Swamiji, when you pour ghee into the fire, it grows larger. Absolutely a fact, but to focus on that destroys the effectiveness of the metaphor. So we have to ignore that if we want to use the metaphor effectively. We have to, that's not part of the metaphor. And then Shankara uses this expression, Atma Agni, the fire of Atma. Atma is limitless. So imagine a yajna with an infinite fire. Is it the problem? Where are you? That works, right? Consciousness being all pervasive, it absolutely works. Anyway, and go back to chapter 4, Bhagavad Gita. You'll see how nicely it works. Okay, let's finish this off. So, Atma being unchanging. Unchanging necessarily means unaffected. Anything that's unchanging is necessarily unaffected, right? To be affected by something is to undergo change. That which is unchanging, that which is unchanging is unaffected. The common word used in Sanskrit is kutastha. Kutastha, often here refers to metal in general, but in particular an anvil. And I don't think any of us have had the experience of a blacksmith. The point is that a blacksmith changes the shape of a piece of metal by pounding on it against the anvil. And the irony is that the anvil is often also made of metal. But the piece that he's working on changes. The anvil doesn't change. So the anvil is the unchanging metal that allows for the transformation of the other kind of metal, the changing metal, just as consciousness is the unchanging revealer of the changing activities of your mind. Okay, before we leave this avastatraya behind, one of Shankara's favorite topics, I'll just remind you, most of you know a metaphor that I've used many times, and some modern metaphor, but extremely helpful in understanding this avastatraya, and that is the example I've given in a movie theater. In a movie theater years ago in America, because I don't think India had double features. Were there ever double features? I don't think so. So
double feature was as long as
Because everything in Bollywood means minimum of 3 hours. ridiculous. Okay. So, but in up until I think the 1960s, and through the 1960s, maybe into the 1960s in this country, movies were double features. You'd get for your, probably in those days, for your 50 cents, you would get to watch two different movies. Imagine 50 cents for a movie. Anyway, in the 1950s, 1960s. So you go into the movie theater and sit down and you'd watch the first feature representing the waking state. Lots of stuff happens on the screen, and it seems to affect you because you get drawn into the drama, as it were, but really speaking, you are unaffected by whatever happens on the screen. It feels like it affects you, but in reality, it doesn't. Just like sadness seems to affect you, but in reality, it doesn't. Then, after the first feature, comes the second feature. Second feature represents dream experiences. So, and completely different. Notice how the first, in fact, I think they would intentionally program two movies that were quite different from each other. And they would do that deliberately. So obviously our waking state experiences and dream state experiences are completely different. But the important part of this metaphor is this. After the first feature and second feature, what they did in those days is there would be an intermission, and then they would restart the first feature, the next show. In that intermission, before the next show, the screen remains dark, and I know they turn theater lights on. Here again, we're destroying the metaphor. Don't talk to me about that. Stay with the metaphor. So in the metaphor, as we're using it here, imagine yourself sitting in your theater chair, staring at a dark screen in a perfectly dark theater in between the two shows. This is, I think, a very nice representation of the dream of deep sleep. Your eyes are wide open, looking at a dark screen in a dark theater. What do you see? Nothing at all. And the reason this metaphor is so appropriate, we talked about karma regulating our sleep cycles. So if you stay in that theater long enough, the first feature starts again. If you stay in that theater long enough, you get first feature, second feature, dark screen, followed by first feature, second feature, dark screen. This cycle of the three, first feature, second feature, and dark screen during intermission, keeps cycling and cycling and cycling day after day after day. And then I love to extend metaphors, so we'll extend it one more step. Suppose you're in that theater. There are some people who really, really like like movies. So you're in that theater day after day after day after day, and after 70 or 80 years, the theater burns down. You're sitting there in a burnt down theater looking at no screen. What do you see? Nothing. There's no theater. No screen, there's nothing to see. But given the fact that you're obviously such a movie addict, what do? You go find another theater. It's a bad metaphor, but it suggests this reincarnation thing. Anyway, you get the idea. As I mentioned, it's Shankara's favorite metaphor, or favorite teaching methodology, prakriya, and I seem to like it quite a bit as well. Okay, this is a good place to conclude our class. I just remind you that this coming Friday is Mahashivaratri, and Saturday morning we will do a simple celebration of Mahashivaratri. Okay, we'll conclude with our prayers. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om Tat Sat. Okay, that is stopped.